Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
NASA policy, commercial space, and nuclear power on the moon. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. From a new interim leader to potential budget cuts, NASA has been going through major changes under the Trump administration. We'll speak with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about these policy changes at NASA and an update on the agency's funding. Then, Acting Administrator Sean Duffy wants to put nuclear technology on the moon for future lunar exploration, national security, and a pathway to get humans to Mars. And finally, the Trump administration signed a new order that aims to help commercial space companies launch faster with fewer regulations and constraints. We'll speak with space policy analyst Laura Forsick about the executive order and the future of commercial space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Just last month, the Trump administration selected Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy as NASA's acting administrator, serving in both roles. In his short time at the helm of the space agency, Duffy has already begun to voice some big changes in projects he hopes to bring to the agency. But amidst leadership changes and new goals, NASA faces a 25% budget cut that would slash science research and exploration like the James Webb Space Telescope, the Martian rovers, and more. So what's happening at NASA, and how are policy changes impacting the space agency and our scientific endeavors in space? Here to answer those questions and more is Casey Dreyer, Chief of Space Policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so since the last time we spoke, NASA now has an interim leader. What do we know about Sean Duffy at the helm?
Well, we know that NASA is not his only job. He's also the Transportation Secretary. We know that he doesn't have a lot of professional experience with space. But we know he seems interested in space and has at least been engaged to a certain degree, but it's uncertain how. I mean, I think at the end of the day, NASA deserves a full-time Senate-confirmed leader. And Sean Duffy, while we're still getting to know him, is at the moment an acting administrator with another job. And we need more for that for NASA.
What has he said publicly about what he envisions NASA as an agency moving forward?
We've seen him say there's two major actions, I think, that we've seen so far, right? Which is, one is this commercial launch licensing, but then also advancing and accelerating a nuclear fission reactor on the surface of the moon, which was a program that had begun years ago with a smaller goal of 40 kilowatts, and now is kind of being accelerated to 100 kilowatts. There's really good reasons to do that. So I'd say that's a promising first step. He's made less promising statements regarding the role of Earth science at NASA, of which I think is not well informed and certainly ignores the statutory requirements of the agency as defined by Congress going all the way back to when NASA was established to understand phenomena in the atmosphere and space.
How does a nuclear reactor on the moon kind of build into these long-standing ambitions of continued human presence on the lunar surface?
If you want to do anything more than a camping trip to the moon, you will need to stay and somehow have power for the lunar night. Lunar nights are 2 weeks long, so solar panels won't cut it. Probably can't bring enough batteries. We need a source of power that is independent of the sun. And for a long time, that's been understood that fission, a fission reactor, is one way to provide that. There have been a number of experiments putting fission reactors in space. And we should say there's a lot of, obviously, nuclear has a lot of work, meaning and kind of history wrapped up in that. But these things don't launch while they're active. They launch inert. And we launch nuclear material into space all the time in plutonium-238, a radioactive material that powers deep space spacecraft like the Voyager space probes or Mars Curiosity and Perseverance rovers. Fission, though, just gives you more power. And if you want to do things like, anytime you take a battery power or direct current and spin something, you need a lot of energy. Spinning things, keeping humans alive, you want to process material on the moon, you want to do good scientific experiments, you want to just do pretty much anything for long periods of time, you need power. And fission is the most efficient way to provide that. And so doing a fission surface project has been a long time part of the Artemis planning and projects. And this just accelerates it again a little higher and faster, very responsive actually to a recent report that came out from Bhavya Lal, who was leading a part of the Biden administration's NASA leadership.
Does this kind of line up with how the Trump administration is setting up the agency for future funding. Sean Duffy says we want to put a nuclear reactor on the moon. This is for longstanding human presence. But the Trump administration wants to cut NASA's funding. How do those two jive together? Do they?
They don't really, which is the interesting detail, right? It's not clear what portion or how much money they're willing to spend on a project like this. I mean, yes, they're proposing to cut NASA by 25%. Most of those cuts come from science and technology, but they also cancel in-space nuclear propulsion efforts at various NASA centers under the technology portfolio. Fission power was preserved, but seemingly at a very low level. This requires more, and it's declared to be in partnership with industry. But at the end of the day, industry needs to be paid. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. So it's really just, frankly, unclear. Add to that the enormous loss of expertise through the workforce departures that we've seen at NASA, numbering about at least 20% now within a single year, just unprecedented in the history. I mean, any business you would work at where a fifth of your colleagues were kind of raptured out of existence in within a single fiscal year, within a single months, would not feel like a growing and dynamic business, right? That's what happens when things are going out of business. So is this proposal, which again is good and sound policy conceptually, Is this possible to do with the incredible workforce losses and the lack of budget? I don't think so. Probably not. But again, we have not seen those details. Either way, it just, you would think it would be more challenging to do that at the end of the day without having that expertise in-house.
Let's talk about that workforce loss, because that continues to increase even since the last time you and I spoke here on the show. What do we know about what's happening with this reduction in force and what impacts that's having now in the short term, and then, you know, these anticipated long-term impacts that you've alluded to a bit, but what do we know about what's happening?
Again, we know mainly through some high-level numbers that NASA has stated, and then through some additional reporting from places like Politico, which got access to more detailed applications of where these losses were. But this is through NASA's deferred resignation program. This is happening broadly through government, where they're encouraging people to basically quit, and that they will pay their salaries through the end of the fiscal year, at the end of September of this year. And then also this kind of combined with other early retirement incentives and so forth. And it seems like, again, that NASA has just been saying yes to anybody, even though they said there would be mission critical people would have said not be allowed to take this program. It's hard to say if that's been the case, because something like over 4,000 people have. And that's, you know, more than 20% of NASA's entire workforce in a single year is disappearing. As of now, NASA has its smallest civil servant workforce since 1961, probably since 1960. When you lose that much people that quickly, do you know how to do things? Do you know how to do things safely? Do you know how to do things efficiently, effectively? I've been saying this for a while, you know, kind of what's the goal here? If the goal is seemingly just to reduce headcount, I guess they're doing it, but what are they sacrificing for that? Obviously, these people were doing something. Even people who are, I'd say, skeptical of the size of government, there's an institutional knowledge that is very hard to maintain when you lose this many people this quickly.
We may not even know what those impacts are until we get into October, November, December, and into the next year, right?
Well, a lot of people have left already. I mean, they're functionally, they've been put on administrative leave. So I think for situations like this, the impacts are normally felt as time goes on, as the pressure internally builds up of the pace of, you know, they're not able to process as many grants. They're not as able to process as many contracts. There's just, they don't have the people to do paperwork. They don't have in-house expertise. They don't have in-house experience. You know, various types of capability are just literally going out the door. And again, you may not notice that right away. And the ability for NASA to make smart decisions about, is this company a viable option for investing in or to rely on for services? Is this plan that we're being told to implement viable? Are there things that we haven't thought of? A lot of people make the connection between the Columbia disaster in 2003 and the workforce reductions that happened in the mid-1990s, which happened over 5 years and much more phased out, which NASA lost 20% of its workforce, right? It puts pressure on the system. And that's the uncertainty that NASA is now shouldering. And the big experiment now we've just imposed on our national space program to handle that type of shock of workforce.
Another issue that the agency is going to be dealing with is the budget process. We've been talking about this on your multiple appearances on the show. Where are we now with this budget process? You've told us that the Trump administration has proposed a massive cut to NASA's budget. How is that fending on Capitol Hill?
Any other time, I think we'd be popping champagne bottles open. We saw from the Senate, their initial NASA budget had a complete rejection of the Trump administration's cuts. They kept NASA functionally flat. They kept science the same. And they actually increased various science missions funding that were all proposed to be canceled. So not only is it like, don't cancel this project, here's a little extra money to, you know, to run this project better. I'd say a pretty clear sign, right, from the Senate. On the House side, the House also maintained the top line levels of NASA. They did not accept the 25% cut that the administration proposed. They did cut science in the House budget, but by 18%, which is not good, but far better than half, which was the proposal. And they move a lot of that money into Artemis and human spaceflight. On top of those, you had the Big Beautiful Bill budget reconciliation that passed that contains $10 billion over the next 7 years, specifically for Gateway, Artemis, institutional investments through human spaceflight centers and various other, you know, and ISS operations and capabilities. So theoretically, on paper from Congress, the intent seems to be, we're not just going to not cut NASA, we're adding resources, particularly for deep space human exploration and human side. Now, we're not popping champagne corks, because we have a very aggressive interpretation of executive power from the budget director at the White House, who says that congressional appropriations are a ceiling, not a floor for spending, and that the president, if he so chooses, cannot spend any money appropriated by Congress. This is the concept of impoundment. Impoundment would, doing so, basically to not spend this money, would be a violation of the 1974 Impoundment Act passed by Congress, and would spark a constitutional crisis that would have to be resolved by the Supreme Court. So we're in a situation where even though Congress is clearly signaling its intent that both House and Senate want NASA to have this funding, and particularly if they're not able to provide it by the start of this fiscal year on October 1st, even though the pathway is trending in that direction, we are very worried that the Office of Management and Budget will direct NASA to functionally impose these cuts right away and in a way that cannot be undone. Right, you turn off some of these missions in space, you do not get them back. I'd say it's debatably legal, but it certainly violates precedent, and it would certainly profoundly ignore not just congressional intent, but public intent, which has been, I'd say, profoundly against these cuts as well.
Finally, Casey, your organization, the Planetary Society, advocates for, you know, scientific exploration of space and a lot of things that NASA does. A lot of people listen to the show want to do that. Do you have any advice as to what people can do in this time of frustration to advocate for NASA and space science?
It's frustrating, but it's also a reminder of why we have organizations like this and why we need all to step up and express, you know, as citizens of our democracy, that we do care about this. So, I mean, my advice is first not to give up in advance. My advice is don't let frustration turn into nihilism or to just say nothing works. It is working. Congress did an extraordinary rejection. This is a Republican-controlled Congress. So we need to not let up on that pressure and to ensure that how things, when things are moving forward, that, you know, among the variety of issues that Congress is handling and dealing with, that we don't forget about the space program. And that even if some of these worst things happen, we do have the capability, and I'd say the responsibility, to build things back in a way that prioritizes this, the gem of our national space program that we have that serves the public interest and does the things that industry is unable or unwilling to do, like scientific exploration, fundamental technology development, while partnering with the best parts of industry to lead humans further into space. Don't get frustrated, you know, turn that into action. I'd say, look at the Planetary Society. We're doing a day of action on the Hill with 13 other organizations this fall. So it's not just us. It's a huge, you know, coalition of groups. We're going to be there right at the start of the fiscal year to voice our support. There's ways to do it online, just to not give up.
Casey Dreyer is the Chief of Space Policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks for joining us again.
Anytime.
Still to come, developing nuclear technology on the moon.
This is not a weapon. We're not talking about nuclear war in space. We are talking about energy. Even when it comes to the moon, we're so used to the sun shining down on the moon that we do solar panels. We do, you know, solar energy on the moon. That's what we're used to. But if we want to stay there long term, if we want to stay there for months, weeks even, we need some other source of energy, and that's nuclear power.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. What's happening on Mars? Martian rovers Curiosity and Perseverance have been busy on the Red Planet exploring Martian craters and dirt to find out more about Earth's planetary neighbor. And the more discoveries the rover makes, the closer they get to answering the question, could there have been past life on Mars? We'll check in on our rover friends on Mars on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about nuclear power plants and a new executive order. Although we just talked about potential budget cuts, acting NASA Administrator, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, is pushing NASA to develop a nuclear power plant on the moon by 2030. Plus, the Trump administration also signed a new order that changes launch regulations for commercial space companies. Here to talk about nuclear power and commercial space companies is space policy analyst Laura Forsick. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks again for having me.
I want to first start with the White House's new executive order as it pertains to commercial space. What do we know about it, and how is this being kind of greeted by the commercial space industry?
This is welcomed news. We've had a lot of setbacks and delays due to regulations and the way that licensing works with the FAA. The Federal Aviation Administration actually is the one who licenses commercial spaceflight launches, landings, and spaceports. And there's been some attempts at reforming the process that have not gone well. So this new executive order is a decision to try to fix what really needs to be fixed and maybe speed things up a bit.
What are those things that needs to be fixed?
Well, there's environmental review. And of course, we want some environmental review, but a lot of it does tend to slow the process down. So they're looking at how they can speed that up. There's also, I'm not going to go into details, but there's something called Part 450, which was meant to speed things up, but unfortunately did the opposite. It was a reform process of how you get licensing for commercial launches. And unfortunately, it did not work out the way as intended. It became more cumbersome for commercial companies to file to launch their spacecraft. And so they're looking at how to reform that whole process that they were already trying to reform.
And it appears that that reform has some bipartisan support in Congress, which, as we know, is quite rare these days, right?
It is. I don't think anybody on either side wants to slow down commercial spaceflight. I think there's a general understanding that companies like SpaceX and others really need to move forward in order to do what the United States government wants it to do, both with satellites, you know, launching, you were about to have the X-37B launch this week, as well as the human spaceflight and what we want to do with International Space Station and then going on to the moon and Mars. We really need to ramp up the way that we do launch here in the United States. And that's a bipartisan welcome thing.
Are these changes happening because of companies like SpaceX that are moving so rapidly? Or are these changes coming because the federal government wants more companies to be more rapid? Or is it a little bit of both?
It's probably both. We know that SpaceX has very ambitious goals as to how much it launches. It just surpassed 100 launches for year 2025. And so who knows how many it'll get to by the end of this year. So they have moved rapidly, but they do come across those barriers, especially when it comes to its Starship, which it has had technical problems. And the review process with Starship does slow things down, as is needed. There's a balance there of how do you do the proper reviews to make sure that everybody is safe on the ground, which is what the FAA is concerned about, and that wildlife isn't negatively affected? And then how do you also make sure progress is still happening with commercial spaceflight?
You mentioned the FAA under the Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy, who is also now the acting administrator of NASA, holding dual roles here. With having the Secretary of Transportation overseeing NASA and overseeing executive orders like this one that we're discussing now, does that kind of, for lack of a better term and without a pun intended, speed things up a bit?
Does seem to be that he has taken to this new role of his. It's a temporary role that he's sharing. You know, he's both acting NASA administrator and Secretary of Transportation, and he really seems to have taken that on and really moved forward some things that have been sitting around. So it's not just a placeholder position for him. I do think that he's really trying to move things forward, especially on the transportation side.
We're mentioning that one of the largest users or beneficiaries of these regulations is, or these changes in regulations is going to be SpaceX, right? Because they launch so rapidly and they launch so much. What are you hearing from other companies that may utilize SpaceX for transportation to orbit, right?
Absolutely. One of the major successes that SpaceX has had that's gone under the radar is the rideshare program. They offer space on a Falcon 9 that is really inexpensive compared to historical options and also pretty rapid in how quickly it can get to launch. So every so often, they will offer space not only on a rideshare, but even just space on an extra Falcon 9 that they can add on an extra payload. And that kind of accessibility to launch is something we really haven't seen prior to the past few years. It is revolutionizing the way people can get launch, you know, get their payloads to orbit. Previously, you'd have payloads sitting on shelves for years, sometimes decades. And it does no good if it's not in space. And so the way that these regulations can be changed to increase launch cadence, again, not only for SpaceX, but for other companies as well, can really help to increase the overall activity that we have in space and open up the options as well. If people think that they can't get their payload to space, they can't get their scientific instrument to space, they can't get their people to space, then they're not going to pursue it. But if they think there's a way and they think they can do it fairly quickly and inexpensively, relatively speaking, then they're going to pursue that as an option.
And Laura, you are a scientist by trade, right? That's how you got into this business here. More opportunities to get more science into space. That's got to be a great thing for the scientific community, right?
It is a great thing. However, under the current administration, we are seeing significant cuts in the science programs, not just at NASA, but throughout the federal government. And these scientific payloads, whether they're built by commercial industry, by universities, or by the governments themselves, by NASA centers, they require money. And usually that money comes from the federal government. Very rare to have an external source aside from the federal government that pays for large scientific missions. And so therefore, we are seeing probably a setback in the ways that new scientific missions and scientific instruments can be built, designed, built, and launched simply because that funding may not be there for the foreseeable future. So it is a give and take. If we increase launch, we still need to be able to have things to launch. And if they're cutting science payloads, it might not be science payloads that fill those rockets.
Is the hope that the private industry will come in and fill that gap? But as you mentioned, these experiments and these missions are quite expensive. And is there any reason for the private industry to step up and fund science?
There are certainly instruments, payloads, you know, scientific satellites that are profitable. But most science is not profitable. That's usually why we don't do science in the near term to get a near term profit. It's usually a far term profit. The investment that the US government and all governments put into the science is expected to have a payoff maybe decades down the road. So unfortunately, when it comes to funding these things, you do get revenue sources, you do get customers, and you get private investors. But even those investors are expecting government funds as well. Over half of the money that comes in to the space industry is from the US government. Globally, it's from governments globally, but within the United States, it's from the US government. And so you do have quite a setback if that funding dries up or is significantly cut from the government. How do you fill those gaps with private industry that's not prepared, that doesn't have those lucrative means of filling those gaps? It's a chicken and egg problem right now.
Laura, we talked a little bit about this. You alluded to it earlier in the conversation about Sean Duffy and acting NASA administrator, some of the things that he wants to do with the agency. And one of those things is putting a nuclear reactor on the moon, which when I say it out loud, it sounds terrifying, but it's actually a really good thing, right? Tell me a bit about this plan and why it's coming to fruition and why we need to have nuclear power on the lunar surface.
This is so exciting. It's not scary at all. This is not a weapon. We're not talking about nuclear war in space. We are talking about energy. Even when it comes to the moon, we're so used to the sun shining down on the moon that we do solar panels. We do, you know, solar energy on the moon. That's what we're used to. But if we want to stay there long term, if we want to stay there for months, weeks even, we need some other source of energy, and that's nuclear power. The moon has this odd, we have to kind of wrap our mind around it, us being Earthlings. It has this odd 29 and a half day. And that means that half of that time is in night. So that's 14, almost 15 days in darkness. So you've got the sun shining on you that you can use solar power for 14 days. But then for the rest of that cycle, that 14 days of darkness, you need some other energy. You can use batteries, but what you really do need is nuclear energy. And this didn't come out of nowhere. This is something that China and Russia are also working on for their nuclear base. So this is a way that we can both do some fantastic exploration on the surface of the moon, as well as hopefully keep up with what China is doing.
That leads me to wonder, is this initiative really for the scientific endeavors that will take place on the moon, or is this a way for this administration to beat China, something that it is trying to do in many different avenues of government? Is this really propelled by the scientific merit, or is this politically motivated?
I'd say all of the above. You have to have that foundation of the technological advancements to have a long-term sustainable presence on the surface of the moon. And NASA has actually to date done very little in preparing for a long-term sustainable human presence on the surface of the moon. And so you need that scientific advancement, that step up when it comes to nuclear energy that we've never seen in space before, in order to make this happen, in order to do a base for scientific reasons, but also for political reasons, geopolitical reasons. Back with the first space race, it was a race between the Soviet Union and the United States. And now we are definitely seeing that it is a race with China. I don't consider it a race. I consider it a competition with China. We have not been racing. We are losing this race if it is a race, because we are definitely behind in what China is doing and plans to do. And this is a way that we can keep up with the plans that they've already enacted, which is a nuclear reactor on the surface of the moon for their own base, and hopefully for our own base as well. And then also, there is something called DuRegard. It's part of the Outer Space Treaty that was signed in 1969. Parties have to have due regard for what's up there, what they're doing, the activity in space. And so if you have a nuclear reactor on the moon, you have to have due regard for what's going on. You have to avoid that area. You can't claim ownership of the moon, but you can have a keep out zone, they call it, a place where it's not safe to do activity in that vicinity. And so it's another way of sort of claiming territory without actually claiming territory.
Finally, Laura, we hear elsewhere in this show from Casey Dreyer from the Planetary Society about funding issues and the funding process, and how, you know, more funding is going into human space exploration at the cost of science elsewhere. But that can be seen as a good thing for, you know, NASA's ambitions to put humans on the moon and then on to Mars. When you look at, you know, the acting NASA administrator talking about putting this nuclear reactor on the moon for this long sustained presence of human activity on the moon, do you see that as a good sign for programs like Artemis, you know, our next human endeavor to the moon, at a time when there is a lot of uncertainty in funding for NASA? Is this a good sign?
It shows the priorities of this administration. They are emphasizing exploration and competition with China over just pure scientific merit. We've seen the cancellation of missions to search for water on the moon. That is a key component of Artemis. So we're seeing the emphasis shift from the pure science of how do you discover what's on the moon, you know, what minerals on the moon, what water, where the water is, to the how do you just get people to stay there long term? How do you get these sustainable bits? And that foundational engineering and supply chain and logistics, that's the emphasis right now. And the science will come, because once you're up there, what are you going to do? You're going to do the science.
Laura Forsig is the founder and executive director of the space consulting firm Astrolytical. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. Our handles on Instagram and Facebook are at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our new intern is Orion Boone. Welcome to the team, Orion. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.